Blog Talk Radio.
Now, PW Torch and Spreaker bring you the Wade Keller Pro Wrestling Post Show. It's time to talk this week's AEW Dynamite on TNT.
Well, Eric, it's been quite the journey the last few weeks, but we now ended up where we thought we were headed, which is a four-way match, MJF defending against Sammy Guevara, Darby Allin, and Jungle Boy Jack Perry at Double or Nothing at the end of the month. Is all well that ends well? What's your assessment? It's been a while since we talked of the journey we went on to get to this point, including this week. What were the ups and downs?
I mean, this week was the best part of this, right? They actually got in the ring. They had a match. It was a, it wasn't like a five-star classic, but it was a good match. It was an acceptable TV main event. I liked it. I liked the little touches that they had with the can they coexist, double can they coexist storylines. I liked MJF wearing an I Love Sammy arm pad there. And I liked MJF busted out a couple of new moves that he hadn't done before. So when you don't wrestle that often, I guess you have time to develop such things. But, I mean, overall, this is – I guess if you're going to peak a somewhat lukewarm angle and heat it up, 3 weeks before – three more Dynamites left before the pay-per-view is the time to do it, right? AEW had 12 Dynamites between Revolution and Double or Nothing. And they started this Four Pillars build – in week two post-Revolution, March 15th. And so, that was when they had the self-indulgent MJF re-bar mitzvah thing that the other three pillars interrupted. That's a lot of weeks of TV to fill. I mean, I think they would have been better served by having MJF have an interim program with somebody, pick somebody off the roster, right? Much like Ricky Starks got a run with MJF after Full Gear last November, December. You could have done the same thing here and then built this up, and then maybe you wouldn't have had to twist yourself into a pretzel. Maybe you wouldn't have had take your eye off the ball promo where Darby and MJF are just ripping into each other and making you like neither of them. So hopefully this is the start of a turnaround of this angle that's sort of been stuck in second gear at best.
So, yeah, they clearly were cognizant of maybe the criticism of going after each other too hard in the first week that they kind of derailed the destination of a four-way and went to the idea of it, of the mini tournament. I get what they were trying to do, but spending the last 2 weeks having them find common ground, but still have some mix-ups or misunderstandings without overdoing it. Like, I didn't feel they hit us over the head with chairs, in terms of the disagreements. MJF waiting for Darby to leave, just lurk. You can just imagine MJF lurking, waiting for an opportunity to corner one of them and make an offer. And it just worked out perfect because Darby walked in on them when Jungle Boy didn't follow him, walked in and saw them hanging out. And, of course, makes sense that Darby would be suspicious because Jungle Boy's made it clear he doesn't like Darby. And then you had the finish of the match with, a blind tag and sort of stealing the pin. All's well that ends well is the argument. And so they're leery of each other. And you want that in this situation, theoretically, because then it doesn't seem like MJF's at a disadvantage against two babyfaces in a four-way if those two babyfaces don't trust each other. And so I think they landed in a good place. I think they told the story better this week than the past few weeks. And that's good. I think going into the four-way match, even though it was clunky, I think we're in a better place than had they not done any of this and just announced a four-way. And, there's other stories they could have told, obviously. But if they didn't have tension between Darby and Jungle Boy and they were just happy-go-lucky, hey, it's great, we got this chance, and aren't we wonderful, I don't know that there would be as much intrigue going into this match. So clunky along the way, but I think they ended up well off. Any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, when you're trying to build stars of tomorrow, because your stars are in their late 30s, early 40s, and they're more injury prone, and they're not always going to be around, and so you've got to build. You've got to pick some people, first of all, which Tony Khan has finally done, and you got to be willing to eat some of the poop along the way, right? It's not all going to be perfect. Tonight they did a lot of pre-tapes, all of the promos that promoted this match, and it was a show-long storyline, right? Like Raw or Nitro back in the day, show-long storyline to promote this main event, which AEW hasn't always done, and they were pre-tapes, right? They weren't making them stand in front of in the ring with a live mic, which is better for, you know, probably better for ratings, but does not set them up to succeed. They set them up to succeed. They could have as many takes as they wanted till they got it right, till they got the story across. So that's a positive as well. If it were me booking this, I'm more boring, and I like in-ring action more than I like anything else. You could have booked this tournament to be a round robin, you know, like a mini
right,
G1, yep. quick G1 style thing. Had all three of them go one and one. I don't think you'd have wanted to book three 20-minute draws, but you know. Each, you know, everybody gets a win on somebody, one and one, and then, hey, sorry, Tony Khan, in Tony Schiavone's ear saying, well, it's going to be a four-way. We tried to settle it in the ring. We couldn't, so here's what it's going to be. I'd have liked that better than what they did, but that doesn't – and it would get you enough weeks of TV to fill time and to build a
yeah.
week after week, but that's just not what they did, and that's fine. They seem to have ended up in a good place. The whole, you know, this whole, a lot of tonight, smartly built matches for the pay-per-view, which is what they need to be doing now.
Yeah, yep. They could have had a 1-1, everyone's 1-1, and then do rock, paper, scissors, Eric. And they all three do rock, and then they all do scissors, and they all do rock, then they all do paper, and then they all do rock. And finally, Tony Schiavone breaks in and goes, Tony Khan's seen enough. Four-way, and MJF throws a fit. What do you think of that?
Would I have hated that even more than what they did?
Yes. I was thinking, what could Tony Khan do logically to other than a four-way? And I was like, you know, how do you do that? And it's like, well, unless you go by record or some tiebreaker based on conference record and, you know, what the NBA and NHL does, rock, paper, scissors. And then I got that devious idea to run by you, and I got the reaction I wanted. Yes, of course. Did this angle tonight, and the story they really told the last few weeks, make Darby, Perry, and Guevara, and really for that matter, MJF, bigger stars, but especially the first three, the challengers. Do you think they, because going into this, the feeling was when they started this, like, those people don't deserve a title shot. What's going on? I mean, Guevara definitely doesn't. You know, he's just been sort of a lackey. And it's not even like Darby and Perry had built up records. So is that at the forefront of anyone's minds anymore? Or did they do enough through promo work and tonight's match to make people think, if they don't think too hard about what qualifies for earning a title shot, that, these guys feel like main event challengers now? Because I don't think a month ago they did.
You know, I'm not there yet, but I don't whatever happens with this four-way, it may be the last match on the show, but it will not be the main event. The main event will be, at this point, the hottest thing they have going, which is Blackpool Combat Club and the Elite, which sort of took a back seat this week, but will get a lot of shine next week in Detroit with the cage match. So, look, they have to deal with these growing pains, right? The only way to build new stars is to build new stars and to give them the ball and see if they can run with it. I'm sure the match at the pay-per-view will be great, and I think that is the one thing that can elevate them as stars if they go, you know, balls to the wall and have a great four-way match at the pay-per-view, and I have every confidence that they will, because they're all they can all work that AEW style, and MJF is a good foil for the other three, you know, not taking risks, and maybe he could be a bit of a base for some of the three smaller guys. And then I guess, too, no one expects MJF to lose the belt, right, in the match.
Right.
It's a foregone conclusion. There's nothing you can do about that, I don't think. I guess you could have MJF lose to one of them on TV at a time, but, I don't think that would be a good use of an MJF loss here. They'll have a great match at the pay-per-view, and then what, right? What's the follow-up? Follow-up has not been AEW's strong suit. Ricky Starks got shot to the top of the card for his TV program with MJF. you know, and he's had some follow-up, I guess, with Juice and now Jay White. But so he's still a pushed guy, but he's not pushed at the top. So,
yeah.
You know, how do you follow up with these three after they don't fail to win the belt? And one of them will take the fall.
I don't know. I am curious in what story they tell in the actual match, because I hope they thought of that. Like, not only do we want to have, because obviously a lot of the top stars are going to be in other matches. And so, and this is, I mean, I'm fine with this match, even if it has the asterisk of they didn't deserve it. And they could have maybe planned a little bit ahead. So it seemed a little bit out of the gate, like they deserved it more to be in this position. But I hope that there's like a larger point in the end too, in terms of where they, how they want fans feeling about all four coming out of the match, what they do next. Because it's like Starks, you know, we're excited about him now. He's nowhere. That happens too often in AEW where you feel like you're investing in someone and then they just aren't around or there's not a follow-up. So I hope that, I mean, does Guevara just go back to where he was? Does Darby and Sting, you know, can pivot to something else? I guess my thinking, and I saved it for last, is I think Jungle Boy gained the most because I think Darby was at a better position than Jungle Boy going in. I think he still is. But I think this is giving Jungle Boy a chance to show that he's pretty good on the mic right now compared to, I mean, he's good compared to where he was. There's an, you know, there's not a flamboyance, but there's an earnestness to what he says. He's not stepping in it in his promos as much or at all anymore. There, you know, this was a good week for him. And I think people are looking at him a little bit more like a top guy. And I think MJF standing in front of his face and saying, you're not world championship material, but you can stand next to the throne. And then Perry pushing back is part of the growth process of Perry. And so I'm answering my own question before I throw it to you, but I'm thinking the goal in all this ultimately should be keep Darby where he was, which is good. Send Guevara back after a quote cute storyline with MJF and the con men conned each other into a bad situation. But mostly, see if Perry can make that next step up to seeming like a legit main eventer. And being put in a main event sometimes is what it takes to have fans perceive you as a main eventer, even if you're put in the main event a little ahead of your time. Your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, we're seeing that in New Japan now. I haven't watched today's big show, Dontaku, but, you know, Sonata gets the belt after years of, you know, just kind of being in the mid-card or upper mid-card and trying and losing to beat Okada, and he finally beats him. And, you know, I guess he's more popular in New Japan maybe than he is to the Western fans, Sonata, with a fresh coat of paint on him. That's the case with Jack Perry. They clearly, they're weaning him off the Jungle Boy name. They're calling him Jack Perry now. He had last year, you know, I think the Jack Perry push would have started a little bit more in earnest last year, but Christian got injured. He had that bad injury. And so it was kind of stalled and delayed, and he was kind of stuck in neutral. And this is the year they seem to be elevating him. He needs to work on his promos big time if he's going to become a main eventer. Because in order to be a top level, perceived as a top level guy in AEW, you got to be able to hang in the ring with a live mic on a promo. I mean, could you imagine him promo battle against Jericho or Moxley or MJF or CM Punk if he comes back? Even Adam Cole. I mean, he would just not be able to hold his own, I don't think.
Do you agree that he's showing improvement or not?
Yeah, he just seems like a sort of naturally quiet, reserved guy, right? He's not, you know, Moxley's just sort of naturally bombastic in his promos, and Punk has his way of connecting with the fans, and MJF is so, you know, studies the past and puts in so much work. And Jericho's been just had so many reps and has reinvented himself so many times over the years. And he's always over. He's the Madonna of professional wrestling. Hopefully without the bad facial plastic surgery, but it's hard to compete with that. And I think until Perry can get on that level. And again, he doesn't have as much experience as any of those wrestlers. It's tough to get a huge main event push. You know, if you're Goldberg and you're like as big as a house, you know, juiced to the gills, super muscular, and your gimmick is that you, you know, bash your head into the wall before you go out for a match, and you can, and you have three moves and your matches are 5 minutes, you can get away with not saying anything, right? You're next. Yeah. It's all you need as a catchphrase. When you're Jack Perry's size, you need more than that.
Yep. All right, well, let's pause and introduce our show formally here and invite participation and then move on to other topics. This is the Wade Keller Pro Wrestling Post Show for Wednesday, May 3rd, 2023. I'm Wade Keller, the host of the show, editor, publisher, and founder of the Pro Wrestling Torch newsletter and the PWTorch.com website, and the host of a wide array of podcasts throughout the week covering wrestling with various co-hosts and some solo updates. Some are free, some are VIP. Search Wade Keller in your podcast app or go to PWTorch.com/goVIP for information on our full lineup of features that I'm part of and a bunch of podcasts also that I am not part of. Real good selection, and we'd love for you to support us, and we'll give you a lot in return for that membership. PWTorch.com/goVIP. This week's Pro Wrestling Torch newsletter is up with a lot of coverage of the WWE draft and my column updated and expanded with thoughts on world title. Who should be the inaugural World Heavyweight Champion of Raw, Circuit or Virgin 2023, whatever we're calling this belt. Also a cover story recapping things in Greg Parks with his evaluation of the draft. So VIP members are reading that tonight. It just dropped along with Newswire and some TV reports and more. All right. The other voice you heard so far on the show is Eric Kroll, a former Pro Wrestling Torch newsletter columnist. One of these days, it's going to be like 40 years ago, but right now it's a little over 30 years ago. Watching wrestling for a long time, a gap in the middle while raising his family. He is back thanks to New Japan and AEW, and he joins us regularly here in the co-host chair covering AEW and once SmackDown, which was fun. Eric, welcome back.
Wade. Sorry, I'm trying to get you prepped for taping The Fix tomorrow with Todd Martin. And that one of the best parts of The Fix each week is when Todd gently admonishes you by saying your name in the way that he does. go VIP and listen to The Fix. It usually posts late Thursday or Friday morning. And it's, you know, for my money, it's the best wrestling podcast in the business.
Well, you listen to a lot of them.
I do.
So, yeah, you've listened to a lot and whittled it down, and I know you're a fan. I appreciate the kind words. Cool. Okay, so if you want to join us here on the show, we got people who have called up. No one's pushed one yet, so you can be first if you push one. The number is 347-215-8558, 347-215-8558. And again, when you call, push one if you want to be on the show. You can also email us at wadekellerpodcast@pwtorch.com. That's wadekellerpodcast@pwtorch.com. We'll let the listener interaction kick off with Zach in Texas, who emailed his thoughts on tonight's show. And he says, Dynamite was a great show tonight. It was an improvement over the last couple of weeks, just in terms of energy. I have to call out a couple big moments in particular. The first was Sheeta's return in her white mob boss suit. The swerve they did with her in the Outcasts reminded me of DDP swerving the NWO in early 1997. I love the concept. Okay, I'm going to pause there because he hits a few things. So we had an angle on the show tonight, Eric, where Sheeta runs out. Looks like she's going to save who am I drawing a blank on?
Willow Nightingale.
Yeah, Willow Nightingale. I'm going to save Willow from the Outcast attacking her after the match, but instead she's got a candlestick in hand and she's like, I'm with you guys. So then the Outcast hold Willow. She's going to spray paint Willow. No more damage is done to Willow, thankfully, because that would have screwed up the angle. And then Britt Baker and Jamie Hayter show up behind the Outcasts, and then Sheeta reveals she's really with them and against the Outcasts, giving us a solid threesome to take them on. So she swerved the heels. We heard the word swerve a couple times, the word work by the commentators. She worked her, and Sheeta pulled one on the Outcast. Was that an unnecessarily complicated journey for Sheeta's return, or did they get something out of that, such as making the Outcast look like fools by leading them on and then pulling the rug out from under them? Did this work as sort of a that type of a swerve, I'm with you, no, I'm not?
I guess marginally it worked. I'm probably not as big of a fan of it as Zach from Texas was. My first thought was, hey, look, it's Sheeta. Where has she been all these months? And Excalibur did helpfully remind us that 4 to 5 months ago, Sheeta was passed over when the Outsiders were formed by Soraya and Tony. I can't remember which one picked who as their partner over Sheeta. The turn out of nowhere would not have made a lick of sense, because there was no – that would have been very, very nitro-y in the bad way in the late 90s, because they did not lay any groundwork for it. But the thing that made me realize quickly that, oh, this has to be a swerve, is Sheeta was wearing all white. And you know who wears white? All white. Good guys, or good gals in this case. And so you know, I guess it worked. This whole storyline has been better in concept than it's been in execution. It's been sort of a lot of weeks, one of the things that's been dragging down Dynamite. So I'll accept the improvement, the marginal improvement. I still don't know where they're going. It sounded like they were going, Jamie Hayter was going to be challenged by one of the three at the pay-per-view, but it sure looks like they're building more toward like a mammoth tag match, maybe with Stips. I don't know.
Yeah, yeah. I think the women's divisions and is improving, and they're taking small steps in the right direction rather than small and big steps in the wrong direction. I didn't have a lot of time to think about Sheeta with the Outcast, but it wouldn't have made much sense if she was. It would have been a bit of an uphill battle to make it seem like she seemed like someone who would want to be with them. But you know, maybe they could come up with some story. Perhaps her absence would have been built into it. But fortunately, that didn't happen. Fans like her. She's talented. Her wrestling style works as a babyface. And I think she fits well if they're going to do some 3-on-3 matches to then set up world title challengers for Hayter. Zach moves on and says, I love the concept of the house rules in the trios matches. That should make them stand out from everything else. So I haven't gone back and rewatched the skit. It's tough doing a live typed up report on Dynamite and rewinding and rewatching stuff. I'm not entirely clear what the rules are, other than they said you don't get to break, the rope breaks don't count, and there's no count out. Did you pick up on what the kind of, can you explain what the house rules were that House of Black explained in that vignette?
I know there were four of them. I will attempt to recap them. No rope escapes. DQ is enforced, I thought.
What does that mean?
I guess unlike every other AEW match where the refs look stupid, I don't know. 20-second count.
In this marriage, there will be no infidelity. It's like, yeah. Okay, well, yeah. The baseline is not assuming infidelity, but go ahead, yeah.
Yeah, so the third thing was 20-second countouts like New Japan and the wrestling world before Vince Sr., I think, introduced the 10-second countout, popularized it to get Bruno some losses, countout losses, so he could build for the rematch at Madison Square Garden the next month. And then the fourth thing was the dealer's choice. Challengers get a stip, you know, because they want to make it fair and all. So I guess
okay. I didn't pick up on that. So that's it. So that they're magnanimous enough to give the challengers a rule that they get to add to their three rules.
Yes.
Is that it?
Yeah. That is the bottom line.
Yeah. So every match will have a different stipulation, and that'll be a mystery that people look forward to being revealed, I guess. Well, so what do you think?
I'm just kind of over the House of Spooky at this point. They're there for a couple of weeks, and then they disappear. I don't know what's going on there. It wouldn't surprise me if they just, you know, who knows what's going on with their contracts. You know, they two of the three wanted to leave last year when Triple H got the book in WWE. I wonder if that's still the case now that Vince is back. And just even talking about these stipulations is triggering me, because it makes me think about the Trios Battle Royal they had, which was just the low point of the show. That was just not great. There were three jobber teams already in the ring, Iron Mike Sharp style, getting no intro. The match itself, the work itself in the match wasn't that great. It was like 10 to 12 minutes, and it still felt too long. But hey, at least we get the Acclaimed on the pay-per-view, right? And the raps about the House of Spooky probably will be fun. Question mark.
I am going to give AEW more credit for coming up with six three-man teams. You know, Tony Nese, Josh Woods, Ari Daivari, okay. Eva Luno, John Silver, and Alex Reynolds. I mean, you got to put Dark Order in there. Butcher Blade and Kip Sabian, that's fine. Hobbs, QT, and Aaron Solo, good. That's, you know, an established group. The Acclaimed, Billy Gunn, established group, Vikingo and Lucha Brothers. I don't know. I'm not as down on are you considering Dark Order a jobber group?
Well, they didn't get introduced, did they? They didn't get their music.
Well, are you really going to do ring introductions for 18 wrestlers, even if you can break it down into, you know, six or not much more than that?
No, I suppose you could bring them out in groups. I don't know. But yeah. It definitely defines them down. Already in the ring, right? I don't even think they got it already in the ring.
It's not good. That's true. It's like when Marianne was and the rest on the Gilligan's Island intro back
right.
in the 60s.
Yes. I think, to me, the highlight of this, you know, low point of the show came before the match even started when the Acclaimed came to the ring and Max Casters had a line to the effect of, Dark Order, it's been years and you still don't have a black friend. I died when he said that. That was so great.
Oh, man.
I had to him. I couldn't tell if the Dark Order knew it was coming or not by their facial reactions or if it stung either way, for sure. I think they had to be somewhat amused by that themselves.
And we got a QAnon reference saying Q and QT stands for QAnon. Reference to the drone hitting the Kremlin.
Yes, we certainly did. Russian propaganda, I assume. I don't know. Seems hard to get a drone that far away from Ukraine, but I haven't really looked into that one yet.
I haven't either, but you know, yeah. The worst part, the most embarrassing and inexcusable mistake of the night was when, did you notice when QT was supposed to trip? Who was it running the ropes? I think it was Phoenix, but it might've been Penta. They were running the ropes and he and Solo were going to grab their legs and QT forgot. So Phoenix had to just pretend QT grabbed his foot. And then he turns around and looks down at him like, you fool, you're standing right there. Remember your damn spot. And it was, I do have lost a little bit of respect for QT Marshall, that he's standing right there for the obvious spot. He's got someone next to him. It's Aaron Solo pulling off the spot. And he loses his train of thought. It's like, I used this as an example this week. When my puppy goes outside to do his business and a leaf blows by, that resets his whole brain. And he's, oh, that's a leaf. And he has no idea why he's outside. QT got distracted or who knows why, saw the blowing leaf, and then forgot to interfere as planned. It was very, very bad looking that Ray Phoenix had to just stop on his own. So shame on QT. You should be embarrassed.
How much respect did you have for QT before this?
he gained some, but it hasn't, just some. There's some work he's done that I've liked, but yeah, QTV isn't doing much for me.
In his defense, he does have to spend hours upon hours formatting the show and or timing things out, right? I can't remember which is it that he actually does. It might be both, but perhaps he's gotten a little. Hopefully, he's gotten a little bit of help from the booking committee that the members of whom QT and Sanjay Dutt seem to be doing a great job of pushing themselves as a time-honored tradition in wrestling going back forever.
Yes. All right, so back to Zach's email here. I wanted to hate the skit at the Briscoe compound, but I just couldn't. Sorry, Eric. He knew what you were going to say. It was great. Oh, maybe you tweeted. It was greatly entertaining. The fact that 30 years later, Jeff Jarrett still thinks he's a country singer popped me to no end. So, yeah, they visited the compound. They did some yard work. The patriarch Briscoe dad shows up and says, watch out for those guys in overalls. But Lethal might, like, I'm thinking it's a Jay White, Jay Briscoe. No, Jay Lethal. It was Jay Lethal is all right, but watch out for the other guys. What did you think of the skit?
Well, I'm going to surprise Zach from Texas a little bit. It was dumb. It was shticky. It completely weird tonally, right, from the rest of the show. Didn't really fit. but I liked part of it for two reasons. One, I just laughed that Mark Briscoe gave his baby to Satnam Singh.
Yeah,
I laughed to no end at that. It just popped me for some reason. It was so out of left field. and deadpan, because Mark can do that. And the second would be, you know what this reminded me of? Like world-class championship wrestling back in the early to mid-80s. They would forever shoot skits where somebody had to go to a farm, or Bill Mercer would show up at somebody's house, and Jimmy Garvin would say, "Bill Mercer, what are you doing at my house?" Right? It, it reminded me of that, and I have a very soft spot in my heart for world-class championship wrestling shows because
deservedly so.
They were the first ones I saw as a wrestling fan, I think even before I saw any WWF at the time. So, you know, I will lament that, you know, this instead of having a killer tag team division where you've got top teams like the Luchas and Aussie Open and FTR and the Bucks trading the tag belts and having five-star classics, now we get FTR jobbing to Lethal and Jarrett. You know, with Sanjay and the booking team making sure his guys get the title shot at the pay-per-view. I just, you know, it's more the lost opportunity that I would lament.
All right. Then Zach says, "I love that they weave the main event story throughout the show and that in the end it was MJF's ego that came back to bite him." So we kind of commented on that. I'm trying to think if there's anything else I want to add. Just the fact that they weaved it throughout the show is good. You know, I mean, sometimes the main event comes on Dynamite. You're like, oh, yeah, that's right. I haven't thought about this for an hour, 40 minutes. Or I didn't even know what the main event was, you know, because it's just like a graphic in the corner of the screen at the beginning of the show and a passive mention going into a break, and that's it. And they did tell the story and weaved it throughout the show. And I'm all for that almost always. I think you building anticipation over the course of an hour and a half, hour, 45 minutes before the bell rings for the main event is almost always a good thing. So props to AEW for doing that.
I think AEW Dynamite has a decidedly different presentation since Revolution. I don't know if is it Mike Mansouri? Is that his name?
I don't know.
He is the result of that. But you know, you get a lot more backstage stuff. You get a lot more of the weaving a story throughout the show, like you would on Raw or even Nitro back in the Monday Night War eras. You get, unfortunately, a lot more of wrestlers looking at a monitor backstage during a match, which is one of the things that I always roll my eyes at. Fewer great matches too, right? I mean, the hallmark of Dynamite was you were pretty much guaranteed a 4-star match every week, and that has not been the case for quite a few weeks since Revolution really blew the doors with the in-ring work rate, blew the doors off. It was such a great pay-per-view from a work rate standpoint that delivered in the end that, there's been a marked change away from these great matches. I mean, I guess there was the Vikingo match with Kenny that I think that was since Revolution, but outside of that, they've been fewer. And I guess as much as it pains me to admit, I like great matches. What sell after a while, though, after 4 years in, it becomes, I've already seen all of the great matches. I've seen every spot there is to see and more on Dynamite. What sells pay-per-views or what gets people to come back? I mean, certainly you can't go wrong with storylines that go through the show if they're done well and episodic television, right? So that is proven to be a winning formula for, at least since the early 80s. So,
well, the goal is get people to feel something and care about what's happening and not just pop for the athleticism. And the athleticism is great. It elevates a match, but it shouldn't be the be-all, end-all. And you know, Jeff Jarrett, I mean, he was making his case in a recent interview for, you know, what he adds. And he was just basically through the young guys under the bus. All these guys looking out here trying to do a bunch of dives and spots. And I'm out here getting the biggest reactions of the night and getting people to care, you know, when I sell and when I get offense in and all that. And, it's good that voice is in the locker room. It doesn't mean people want to see Jeff Jarrett matches more than the Lucha Brothers or Kenny Omega or whatever, but that there you can elevate what the younger people in their athletic prime are doing by learning the tricks of the trade from what Jeff is out there doing at his age, with obviously less star power, charisma, and athleticism than some of the people that he believes he is showing up. But there's something to be learned from that. And when you can combine the two, that's when you become a much bigger star.
Yeah,
and AEW is moving that direction.
All things in moderation except virtue, you know. Don't go too far in one direction or the other. A nice blend is usually gets you to the promised land, to the finish.
And I mean, nobody who makes fun of AEW being pointing camera at the ring with no buildup or very little buildup, assume knowledge of an audience that a lot of the audience that you're hoping to attract or retain doesn't have, and then have everyone do a bunch of eye spots and not sell. Nobody who's critical of that wants to see just Jeff Jarrett matches. You know, like it's the blend of the best of both worlds. It's dialed down a little bit, gratuitous high spots and a lack of selling and storytelling. Turn up the build, the promos, the angles. Ideally have face heel matchups most of the time, so fans are invested in the ebb and flow of the match rather than just popping for spots. But yeah, there's tricks of the trade that that you can watch. You know, old Jerry Lawler matches. Jeff Jarrett learned from the best when it came to that. And there's an efficiency and the stuff you do between moves that pulls people in. And AEW's on a journey. That locker room's on a journey to learn that. But, you know, that I think that's why Tony's given Jeff the TV time he is. And Jeff is well-liked backstage. You know, people like him. He's, you know, completely checked out of being in management. He just – I mean, I know he does the house show stuff. But backstage, he's just one of the boys. And he is that sage locker room voice for some of the younger guys. And I think he's passing along some good knowledge. And that's not to endorse even more TV time for him, you know, at the expense of others. But there's some good that he's bringing for sure. Oh, go ahead, Eric. Yeah.
I had a broader realization tonight as I was watching Dynamite, and the product has, you know, Dynamite's had some bumpy. It's been bumpy since Revolution, right? Uneven. Felt, you know, flat at times,
yeah.
Even.
Yeah, for sure.
Part of that is maybe trying to implement a new production style. Part of it maybe Tony Khan's been busy working on all these other big deals that are about to come to fruition. But I think the promotion, it's like they know they have a big summer coming up with an alleged second TV show Collision on Saturdays. That's doubling their number of live hours of TV every week. CM Punk's alleged comeback, a big show in London, and then All Out, you know, but Punk's comeback at the United Center, and then potentially there was some talk about they were inquiring about All Out being at the United Center, presumably with a big Punk match. It's almost like for this pay-per-view cycle, this three-month cycle, they're saving the good stuff, right? That's why they're burning off a Four Pillars world title match and trying to, you know, pawn that off as a worthy main event of your $50. And I, you know, I mean, look, AEW has an impeccable record of delivering the goods on pay-per-views. I don't think there's ever been an awful one. They've all been good to great. You know, you're entitled to a clunker 4 years in, I suppose, or one that just feels like treading water because, hey, the big summer blockbusters are about to arrive.
Yeah, and I mean, I think Paul Levesque's booking in December felt like the same thing. You know, we're coming up on Rumble and WrestleMania, and we're just kind of filling time and catching our breath. And there was a little bit of that. There were some unforced errors that is different than just downshifting a little. That I think, you know, they should be held accountable for. But you're right. I mean, things are going to pick up, and the ratings have not been good. They're down year over year, but. You know, there's reasons for that. Some out of their control, some in their control. But this is going to be a hot summer. I mean, I think things are, you know, use the Jim Ross line. Business is about to pick up in a lot of different ways. And obviously the big ticket sales, which they drew attention to and they ought to have for the pre-sale, drawn, you know, 36,000 at one point in pre-sale tickets. And Taz updated that to 45. Is that an actual number, Eric, that you've heard? Or did Taz just add on?
I believe Tony Khan tweeted out today that it was 43, but that was in the morning. I know there's a time difference. So, I'm unclear however many thousands of people, 60,000 people or whatever it was, who requested the codes, have they been able to buy yet, or is it just the Fight TV people? I have not followed the nitty gritty of this because I'm not on Twitter for wrestling as much as I used to be. So.
I think it is people who everyone who pre-registered has access, and then the general public Friday. I'm real curious where they are come, you know, Saturday morning, in terms of what second wave do they have, who didn't get pre-sale credentials, or did get the pre-sale advantage. Is there anyone left? You know, is it just hardcore? There's 40, and by the way, $45, if they don't sell 5,000 more tickets and they end up with, you know, legit 48,000, that's a success. They are already a success.
For sure. Yep, for sure.
But the fact that the baseline is already a success before they open up sales to the general public, and then there's months more of ticket sales when they actually announce matches and maybe Punk's return. I mean, there's a chance they sell this thing out. There's a chance they have what appears to be a packed stadium, even if they, you know, have to reserve some spots, quote, for production needs that they could sell if they needed to. This is going to be impressive, and it is a visual, like, landmark moment for AEW that, you know, sends a message to corporate partners, advertisers, future, current and future TV partners that this company has wind at its back and a big fan base. Now, AEW's history is they draw well the first time in a city, and then there, you know, often is a drop-off, which is, by the way, no shame in that. That's just kind of normal, you know. But this is a very big debut in the market. I don't know that they can get away with making an annual event out of it at Wembley, but this is a really good, I think, morale boost too for Tony Khan and in that locker room, kind of in a way, but at a larger scale when TNA would go to the UK and they draw the biggest crowd they ever drew, and the crowd is super into everybody, and the TNA wrestlers are like, oh my God, why don't we get this in the United States? So AEW is going to have a larger version of that this August.
Yeah, it'll be impressive. They should go shoot many shots of fans in the concourse buying gimmicks and buying souvenirs and buying popcorn and stuff to satisfy the scratch Wade's itch. That'll be the thing that puts AEW over the top, I think.
So unnecessary. All right. So final comment from Zach. I love that they weaved the main event story throughout the show. And okay, I already covered that. To answer a question you posed in your recap, Wade, I think the fact that the BCC are using screwdrivers on people is plenty of reason to boo them, unless you're secretly a sadist, who in which case it might be your thing. So Mox, Danielson and Mox are out there going, you know, it's kind of egotistical of Bret Hart to say he's the best there is, the best there was, and the best they ever will be. Who is he to say that? And then Danielson's like, I'm the best right now, implying I'm better than Bret ever was, but somebody's going to be better than me. I hope that's somebody who's in the Black Bull Combat Club. I want to pass on greatness, and I want greatness to be better than me, and I want to be part of making that happen. And I'm like, yeah, that's great. And then Moxie's like, you know, cuts his promo on Kenny, and it's not, and he's stealing lines from me. It's not 2019, 2020 anymore. What's the 2023 version of Kenny like? Let's test it out in the cage. You're living on your past glory. Step up, prove to me you're not. I'm going to make you bleed. It's like, that's a badass babyface promo from both. And that was my point. Of course, if you brought in and out Zach, there are reasons to not like, Blackpool Combat Club, but, man, that to me, that was like a babyface promo. And if they're trying to get heel heat, they are bad at their jobs, Eric.
Well, I'm of course going to pop for Danielson burying Bret Hart. Danielson better than Bret Hart? ? Yes, yes, yes. That's what my notes say. Bret Hart's always been sort of full of himself, a little self-important, but that, you know, that was his gimmick, right? I mean, he that catchphrase was his heel gimmick line in the 90s, maybe even his babyface line in the 90s. Yeah. And it's fair game for somebody to point out to call his bluff on that, right? I would hope there's somebody better than Bret Hart, just as I hope that there'd be a bigger draw than Bruno Sammartino, and there has been, at least for, you know, shorter periods. Hogan and Austin come to mind. And it felt like Moxley was doing his best to try and put some meat around this cage match that has had, I mean, I guess the build is that the Blackpool Combat Club keep coming after the Elite with screwdrivers, right? That's the macro build. But it seems like they just announced this cage match on Rampage, and this either started on Rampage or on social media.
Yeah.
I feel like I missed a step, and that may be on me for not watching something, but do you
know? No, it's not. I had the same feeling. You have Moxley cutting a promo about a match that Excalibur then announced for the first time in front of their largest audience after the promo aired. They got that backwards.
Okay, so it's not just me.
No.
Yeah,
or it's us, or it's just us. Maybe
yeah.
It's not just you, but it's us.
Could be. do they need, it seems like a pretty huge match to throw out there. You know, I don't want to be, I'm being the guy that has historically complained that Tony Khan is stingy with his top matches, his big matches. But yet here he is throwing this on TV with, like, you know, a few weeks built. I get that it's part of the broader feud that they have going on. Did he need to sell tickets in Detroit? Are they not?
You know what?
A big arena and not that, you know.
Viewership's been down, and I think as promoters do, when they want to pop a rating, they go, what can I do that will pop a rating but also not interfere with a pay-per-view that I'm trying to sell? And, you know, it's a big match. But you draw a big rating, and that's your vehicle to then get people excited about a match with more people involved, obviously, heading into the pay-per-view. So I don't know. If viewership was up, I'm not sure he would have had this match. For people who don't read my ratings report at pwtorch.com or listen to my analysis on the VIP hotline side of things, the average viewership for Dynamite this year through 17 weeks is 895,000 through 17 weeks last year, it was 989,000. Some of that's cord cutting, but some of it's not, because the rating, which is just percentage of homes that have cable, is also down. Viewership's down about 10%, and ratings are down about 5%. And, you know, that's the CM Punk factor, other things, maybe a bad stretch of shows or below par batch of shows. How do you spark that? You do a Moxley Kenny Cage match. Announce it ahead of time, have them cut promos about it ahead of time, and you know, jostle some people who have fallen out of habit of watching to go, well, I need to tune in for that. And then, of course, the key is that's the show you should put the most effort into and feature your top stars in the most compelling way possible, so the people who tune in for that cage match aren't one and done, and they buy the pay-per-view, and they keep coming back week after week. So that's a big week, because it's not just the cage match. I'm really curious what Tony Khan and company do in the other hour 40 minutes that isn't that main event, to get people into the product. That has not been a consistent strength of Dynamite. Sometimes they'll have a big match, but the rest of the show can feel phoned in or just average. So take advantage of it if you're going to give a match of that caliber away, Eric.
I agree. I feel like who won the last match? It was the exploding barbed wire death match where the explosions were more like, you know, when the explosions fizzled. And that was so.
And Tony Khan showed a side of himself that people hadn't seen before. With the criticism afterwards,
So Moxley's got to win this match, this cage match, right? Because Kenny beat him for the title, and then Kenny beat him in the rematch with the non-exploding barbed wire. And so psychology would dictate you are putting heat on the heels if the faces are going to get their revenge at the pay-per-view, right? You're trying, that may be the single biggest selling point of this pay-per-view so far, is the Elite finally getting their revenge on the Blackpool Combat Club. So I think, Moxley's got to win, and it'll be interesting how they, is that the main event? Does that start the show? Is that at 8 o'clock? Cause you know, it does take some time to put up and take down a cage, I guess not as much as it used to, now that they can just, lower it down into the ring. But, Detroit is at, I assume they're at the big basketball arena in downtown Detroit these days, and they're at 5,281 as of Russell Tick's last count. And so, that's, you know, certainly not as much as the first time they were in Detroit, and I think probably they're trying to sell a few tickets as well.
Yeah, that's a good point. It's not just ratings. Yeah, it's about getting a big crowd in a big city.
Yep. So, looking forward to that.
What do you think of Serious Kenny?
He felt like he was on Quaaludes or something. I'm not a drug guy. Are Quaaludes downers? Downers are.
I interviewed Road Warrior Hawk in about 1992, give or take a year, and I was told he was on Quaaludes for the interview. It is in our radio show archives for VIP members. It is quite the experience, and it's
like,
that. You know?
Like, literally, he was legitimately on Quaaludes, not making a joke.
Okay. No joke.
I mean, it checks out. It makes sense, given his addictions. But.
Exactly, and I will not imitate it, but because it would seem offensive to various people to even try to imitate it. But in my head, I can hear it. And it was very, it was very uncomfortable for everybody. You know, he, but so anyway, not to belabor the point, But that Kenny was not on Quaaludes if Road Warhawk was. Kenny was on something. No, I should say he was on something. He was on, if he was on something, it was, like you said, a downer. But Quaaludes causes you to just not talk like normal.
He was trying to be serious, and that I prefer serious Kenny to everything's a joke weirdo Kenny at this point, for sure. I prefer New Japan Kenny to AEW Kenny. The part for the promo for me that didn't work, and it's been the piece of the storyline that hasn't worked the entire time, is, you know, Don Callis, basically after Kenny got a couple lines, took over the promo, and Don Callis is the world's better promo than Kenny Omega, but there's a fundamental problem in that Don Callis is an unlikable, weaselly, conniving heel that nobody likes, and he's trying to play his cut, his giant Harry Potter times 10 scar, for babyface sympathy, and it just doesn't work. I was like, I hope it hurts, Don. I hope I hope John Moxley sticks his finger in it and opens you up again, right? I mean, that's not the intended effect they were going for, I don't think.
No, not at all. You get my Angel Martin reference, my Rockford Files reference, when I talk about Don Callis. You know, they can play up him being the Angel Martin of to Kenny Omega's Jim Rockford in terms of the sleazy friend, but, you know, if he's good enough for Jim, then I'll like him.
Yes, I remember the Rockford Files from syndication, but
yes.
I don't remember the sleazy friend as well. But
you don't remember Angel Martin? Angel
did a good job describing it. Yeah,
he is. Angel is one of the great character actors in television history, and it's worth pulling up a clip, kids. And Angel, he's fantastic. Rockford Files was a very top shelf show for 1970s and highly respected.
Probably on Tubi or Pluto, these channels that rehash and try and get the last remaining value out of those intellectual properties for the studios that made them.
Yeah. All right. Did I finish Zach's email? What do you think of the screwdrivers? The screwdriver being used as a weapon.
It feels very ECW Abdullah the Butcher hardcore. I didn't see Hangman Page get busted open, and we haven't heard, unless you watch Being the Elite, which not that many people do anymore, relatively speaking to its heyday, you wouldn't know that Hangman had an eye patch over his eye, and my DVR, I don't think I watched it live when they did the Takeshita screwdriver work. So I think I missed that. I think my DVR cut it off for some reason. So I've yet to actually see the screwdrivers in action, although I appreciate – I mean, it certainly gets you over as a heel, right, if that's your goal. It's pretty good stuff.
I do not like it because it's the old Triple H sledgehammer. It can't be used at full force without permanent injury or death. It's just – it's like brass knuckles, okay. In a real-life situation, someone with brass knuckles, it's probably as serious as a screwdriver. But you can imagine getting hit with them and being knocked out, having a concussion and a big bruise and all that. But a screwdriver to your face, it's going to tear your skin, possibly jab your eye. You know, there's going to be something sort of permanent about it if you use it the way that you would if you were defending your family against an intruder. And why wouldn't they if they're using it? It's the old sledgehammer with Triple H, where it's like he never swung it. If he was winding up to swing it, you knew it wasn't going to happen. Someone's going to intervene. But he could put his hand over it and jab you with it, and that would always work. But it was just obvious that it wasn't going to work. You just don't bring basically deadly weapons into pro wrestling because you're not going to use it in the way that people would if they were really trying to use it. And it just feels over the top, gratuitous, and unnecessary. So my answer to my question is I would veto the use of weapons such as a screwdriver.
I think they got juice both times, right? They got blood.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
Yeah.
I understand your point. Yep.
Yeah. All right. So up next, JB from Detroit says, it's not specifically Dynamite related, but it was announced today by Tony Khan that Will Washington has been hired as a continuity coordinator by AEW. You know, other duties listed too. He will also help with long-term creative. You've been beating the drum that this was a critical need for AEW since the beginning, so this seems to be a bit of good news heading into the debut of Collision in June, a little bit to be taken off of Tony's plate, which is already overflowing. I'm for Tony building a robust support team. I don't know if Will Washington would be good or not at it, or, you know, he listed a lot of duties he might have, but the idea of somebody it goes to our point about the announcement of the cage match and how they announced it on Dynamite after a promo hyping it. There's just having a fresh set of eyes look at everything that's going on and saying, oh, wait a second. This storyline was part of a vignette on Rampage a week and a half ago, but we haven't talked about it on a Dynamite since. And now we're doing a major angle that we want people to react to in the building and watching at home. Let's make a deliberate effort to recap it or have the announcers cover it, maybe do a promo ahead of time, do something to refresh and remind or introduce the feud to our biggest audience. And if that's what he's doing and, if that's part of his job, I think a fresh set of eyes for a staff that's worn pretty thin otherwise is a good thing. Eric?
I'm going to tread lightly here since I'm not familiar with Mr. Washington's work. It's a good thing for AEW to appoint a person who's in charge of continuity.
Yes.
The downside is that I think, I guess to me there's, let me establish my bona fide media credentials. I was a newspaper reporter and editor for more than a quarter century in Chicago at the, including at the biggest newspaper between the coasts. Might no longer be true, but was at the time. And so I know a lot about the media. And in the wrestling media, there are content creators and there are journalists. Wade, Dave Meltzer would be a journalist, among others. Todd Martin from the Torch, more of an analyst, not much of as much of a scoop guy as he is, a smart analyst. And then there are content creators who create content, and these are some of the people you hear asking dumb questions at the AEW pre-pay-per-view and post-pay-per-view scrums. And when I don't know which category Mr. Washington falls into, but when someone who is part of the quote wrestling media goes and takes a job with a major wrestling promotion, it reinforces the idea that for those who don't know the difference between content creators and actual wrestling journalists who try and break news and bring decades of institutional memory to the business they cover, it gives the impression that content creators who get painted with the same brush as journalists, I suppose, for a lot of people, they don't know the difference. That they're just looking to get hired by a wrestling promotion. And I don't know if that's the case here, because I don't know if Mr. Washington was an analyst and brought the criticism, or if he was more of a content creator type who sort of wasn't critical of anybody, keep his lines of communication and access to guests open. So that would be a concern. Boy, that sounds like a really tough job for anybody, and I wish Mr. Washington luck because, man, do they even – I guess it's not like WWE where Vince is changing the scripts, when Raw or SmackDown is already on the air. But in that job, you have to be able to see close to a – to really excel at it, you have to be able to have really good critical thinking skills, and you have to be able to see beforehand, Dynamite goes on the air, okay, here is what they're saying in this pre-tape, here's what they're doing here, to be able to be, the catcher in the rye and prevent the bad things from happening, right? You need to see that ahead of time. And I don't know AEW's production to know how far in advance or how detailed the scripts are. And, it's a tall ask for anybody in any wrestling promotion. And then three, the funniest thing to me will be a running bit where AEW has a gap in continuity and it's bound to happen and everyone's going to be tweeting and posting about, oh, Will Washington fell asleep at the wheel again, right? Even though it almost assuredly probably will not be his fault.
Yeah, I think they should have two continuity coordinators, one who only watches Dynamite, has no social media accounts, never watches Rampage or AEW Dark. And it can be just watching the show and giving feedback on what they didn't understand or didn't have a context for, or look at the script ahead of time and go, wait, I only watch Dynamite. I don't know what any of this means. That would be helpful, because if Will Washington's watching everything, he's going to have to keep track of what he saw on Rampage versus Dynamite, or what he read on the internet, or what video, Matt Hardy put out online that almost nobody, that a tiny percentage of people watching Dynamite have seen, but it's integral to the storyline. And so you need somebody who either only watches Dynamite or watches everything, but is really good at keeping track of what only has been on Dynamite. And now there'll be another, you know, anchor shows to add to the mix probably.
I mean, to do well in this job, you almost have to have the mind of a lawyer or a judge, in that when you're in court and you're in a trial and you're about to question a witness, you know, the judge will often say, oh, you haven't laid the foundation for that, right? You haven't laid the foundation for X is literally one of the big problems in AEW, you know, 4 years in, right?
It's Tony Khan is too good of a memory. I mean, Tony Khan remembers everything, and he doesn't relate to people who don't, and he watches everything, and he doesn't account for people who don't. And it's a strength of his in certain regards to his business. His memory is amazing. I mean, he's told Jeff Jarrett things about Memphis Wrestling that Jeff Jarrett was part of, that Jeff Jarrett has no recollection of, and Tony can repeat it word for word. I mean, but the problem is it makes you can't relate to the average viewer you're chasing down. And that's where, you know, again, a continuity coordinator would be good. Yes, if you are, you know, portraying yourself as a reporter, but it turns out your goal was to not upset the promoter you were covering because you were looking for work, that is a bad look. He might be in a better place now, a more appropriate place for himself than his previous role. How do you feel about press secretaries, you know, who stand at the podium representing presidents, then moving on to cable news or network news? George Stephanopoulos was the first one I noticed who did that. I'm like, wait, you were an advocate for a president, PR person, basically, for staying at the podium talking to reporters, but now you're this objective reporter, not a Democratic analyst, but like an anchor. And I've always had trouble wrapping my head around being a partisan and then going on to be a journalist. I think someone's capable of doing that and flipping the switch, but there's so many to choose from. It feels more like a celebrity ratings grab than the best person for the job.
Well, that's what I do in my line of work now, more or less, a communications person for a statewide official in Illinois. And I am a former journalist.
That's the right order. That's the less conflict.
Right. Well, the problem would be if I tried to go back, right?
Yeah.
I mean, I think in covering politics, once you align yourself with a candidate of either party, it's really hard to put the toothpaste back in the tube, right? You've declared a political allegiance, and so everything you write or report or analyze has to be, you know, filtered through that. I guess if you're going to be an analyst, political analyst on CNN, it's fine because they can just provide that context. Former Reagan speechwriter, former Clinton spokesman. So that's okay. But if you're going to try and go be a straight news reporter, you know, you've passed beyond the veil, I think, is the phrase they use in the business. You know, you've gone to the dark side, can't come back to the light side.
All right. Back to JB from Detroit. He goes, I feel as though Roddy Strong should have some sort of promo or backstage segment or video package explaining who he is and or what his mission statement is before he debuted in the ring. Many Dynamite viewers who might not be familiar with his work likely don't have much of an emotional investment in him tonight as a result. I think that's important when you're pushing somebody big like Jay White. I think the story sort of tells itself with Roderick. Oh, there's a history with these two. You know it or you don't, but now it's certainly more than implied. It's just, it's apparent that these two are old friends. And I don't know that you need to devote a bunch of TV time to the backstory. I mean, you can argue that it's not great for Cole to just be, you know, rehashing NXT storylines and maybe come up with something original. But that's a separate point from JB. But normally I'm all for giving a bunch of background. But, I mean, with all the respect to Roderick Strong, I mean, I think what we need to know about him, we kind of know. And if they want to tell a story, they can show us, not tell us from here. How about you?
Yeah, I mean, Google is your friend, I suppose, if you want to know about Rod Strong. He's had a long history in wrestling, you know, TNA Impact, you know, or Ring of Honor as well, I think. So you can find out all about that. I think, you know, Tony Khan probably knows all that and assumes all the fans know that, and many of them probably do, but you know, some.
But those who, like, there's situations where I fiercely believe that you shouldn't send people to Google to do homework in order to then backtrack and become invested in a major angle that you hope got an emotional reaction out of your audience. You should tell a story from scratch and not assume knowledge on certain things. I just don't think Roderick Strong reaches that bar. You know, Roderick Strong's whole role is he's friends with Adam Cole, and he's not an alpha, but he's a good friend. And now there he is. And I honestly, I for this, it's an exception that I think illustrates the rule.
Yeah, and I'm not sure that Roddy Strong doing a solo promo is necessarily showing off his strengths, as which are more of the in-ring variety than the promo ability. It, you know, and to your point, probably where he settles in is as a gatekeeper face for Adam Cole, right?
Exactly.
He'll be the one to get beat by the heel before the heel takes on Adam Cole at this point.
Yes, gatekeeper Roderick Strong. All right, third out of four from JB. Was the BCC's backstage promo intended to be babyface? What Danielson said about building a foundation for future wrestlers rang very face to me. It was a babyface promo. And that gets to the larger issue of, should you let wrestlers like Moxley and Danielson, who have more fun being heelish or more edgy and not following rules, should you let them indulge in that and then go opposite of Kenny and the Bucks, who are aligned with Don Callis, and, you know, get a mixed reaction because some people are pro-punk, some people are pro-elite. You've got half the fan base, give or take, ready to turn on them in a second, and you take some of the coolest, most respected people, let them, quote, have fun in the sandbox, pretending to be bad guys, and then you put them against babyfaces, who you really want to be babyfaces, and they're not going to get cheered by as many people, and it just seems like a counterproductive situation to me, and this promo didn't help. I mean, Danielson's goal, and I know they just want to reinvent heel face and carve out this third category and all that, but it's fun in theory, sort of like wrestling rankings are fun in theory until you actually have to do it every week and match it to your booking, and then it falls apart. That is not high IQ character portrayal to me in terms of the idea, because you can't execute it and get a desired result that generally draws money in pro wrestling. Eric.
Yeah, I don't have anything to add from when we discussed this previously tonight.
All right. So then, number four, I think Christian is one of the better possible feuds to help Wardlow recapture the overness he had immediately post-defeating MJF at Double or Nothing last year. Perhaps Double or Nothing will become Wardlow's pay-per-view, similar to how Undertaker was synonymous with Survivor Series. Is that a fifth point? Oh, no, that's a sub-point to point four. Okay, why was Wardlow so mad? Why was he yelling? Why would, like, there's an open challenge, get out here. It's like, I get it why Adam Cole's mad at Jericho. Why was Wardlow mad? What caused him to decide I'm going to be at level 10 of anger for this entire promo?
Well, one possibility is that after 4 years in AEW, Wardlow has decided to develop a single personality trait that anyone could ascribe to him. Other than the Powerbomb Symphony in the ring, that's one possibility. I guess the other one is, you know, Christian and Luchasaurus have been playing mind games with him and not really, you know, sort of coming out and not saying anything and going back and kind of effing with Wardlow's head. And so he was mad. That's why he was mad.
But that emotion he's exhibiting is not, oh, you called me out on a video and played mind games. Like, that was... You broke
into my car and stole my passport, and yeah, like that kind of anger that he has made then, right?
No,
yeah.
No. Wardlow's promos are living down to the stereotype of this big muscle head. And the thing is he's got nuance. He's showing nuance. But his facial expressions look like he's in the middle of a deadlift where he had, you know, 20 pounds too much on the bar. And then he's just straining and struggling while he talks. It's like, just chill out and talk normal. There's that one sit-down promo, and it's like, more of that. And now we're getting this just the you know, when wrestlers think, I'm going to make my promo better by yelling and being angry, out of proportion to the circumstances, it is it's not good.
Perhaps he had stock in the company that's suing AEW over suing Luchasaurus over his mask. I don't know. I was confused that they threw in the twist that Christian's title shot. Wardlow was definitely confused in the ring, and I thought Luchasaurus looked confused as well.
Yes, none of that made any sense. And it's like Arn is trying to give Wardlow what seemed like a pep talk, like, "Oh, calm down, it'll be okay." It's like, why shouldn't Wardlow be smiling and nodding, going, "Bring it on, I'll kick your ass, Christian." I mean, Christian, you could argue, should be protected and portrayed as a bigger star than Luchasaurus, but Christian is the veteran part-time wrestling advisor to this up-and-coming monster Luchasaurus. That's the premise of their pairing. So if that's the premise of the pairing, Wardlow shouldn't see it as some unfortunate, scary curveball that he just got thrown at him, but sort of like Wardlow getting his hands on Christian, given the setup and where Christian is right now, should be what Wardlow gets if he beats Luchasaurus. I get Christian in the ring, and the fans should cheer, like, you know, Bobby Heenan getting stuck in the ring with Hulk Hogan or something because Hogan beat one of Bobby's guys. Like, it just, I didn't get the logic. I don't get what the Wardlow's emotional response was, and like you said, is Luchasaurus in on this or not? I just didn't think it was a coherent story. It's not apparent to me what they were going for, and I don't think they executed. If they had a plan in mind, they executed it poorly.
Khan is paying Christian a lot of money and probably wants a little bit of return on that investment. And it's not the worst thing in the world for Christian, a veteran who's skilled at putting matches together, to try and help Wardlow through a slightly longer match. Teach him a little bit, maybe, in this program. I don't know. I'm looking for the silver lining here.
Well,
I'm kind of grasping at what I'm, you know.
I think that'll all happen. But can't you tell a coherent story to set it up? I mean, you can have both. One doesn't, like, why is Wardlow yelling? Why did Christian surprise him? Why is Wardlow saying, I want an open challenge? And, like, I don't know. It's just, none of it makes sense.
I'm willing, because this is such a new storyline, I'm willing to go to the refuge of scoundrels and wrestling criticism and say, let it play out.
Yeah, I don't think there's anything that can happen the next few weeks that will make tonight make sense. I don't think the let it play out rule applies to this. But I hope somehow they can turn this into something that in retrospect makes sense. But I think when you say let it play out, that's more something is executed well that you disagree with. But you see what they were going for and you just disagree with it. And you go, but let's see why they did this, because it's apparent what they were trying to do. They did it well, but I disagree with it. But maybe later when I see where they're going, it'll be something that I'm not as down on. This just doesn't feel like it was well thought out or well executed, or they even knew what they were doing. It just, and yeah. And Wardlow didn't need to be so mad.
Those are usually the two reasons when something doesn't go, you know, when something doesn't make sense. Not well executed or not well thought out. The two most likely culprits.
Yeah. Yep. All right, it's on in St. Louis. Says, hello, Aiden. Eric, it was nice to change up the show by going to the farm with Mark Briscoe. How do you feel Mark's character has been portrayed in AEW so far? I think going to the Briscoe's farm and having Mark in his element is the best portray. I think it's the most effective introduction for a lot of people of who Mark is. I think they could do more in that regard. I don't know that it's worth doing more in that regard in the context of AEW, but if you're going to have Mark part of a storyline, and this is, you know, very mid-card storyline with him, then you might as well let us, you know, kind of give us a window into his world. And I mean, the baby in the arms of this giant, and then he wanders off with a baby, and the dad's like, yeah, watch out for that guy and those people in the overalls. It's like, there's a baby that just got taken from you. Maybe that should be your concern, not who you can trust in a future tag match. Eric, what do you think of Jay so far? Or Mark so far, sorry.
So Mark Briscoe is sort of the glue for this storyline, right? He's friends with FTR because the Briscoes had those legendary matches. Certainly two of those three matches ended up in my top 10 of the year last year, FTR and the Briscoes. And so, you know, at the end of that, they all, you know, hugged or raised each other's hands after the December ROH pay-per-view when the Briscoes finally prevailed. And so, you know, that's why he's friends with FTR. And then apparently he's been longtime friends with Jay Lethal from Ring of Honor. And so he's just sort of a plot device, I think, for this feud. This feud that I could really have done without. I think Mark's bigger role is going to be in Ring of Honor this year. Everyone expected in the March pay-per-view, the night before WrestleMania Night 1, that Friday night, that he would beat Samoa Joe, because they'd set up the storyline that it's the one ROH title he's always wanted and hasn't gotten, and everyone expected him to beat Samoa Joe. His family was in the front row, and then he lost. And so I assume that they were setting him – his story for the year will primarily be in ROH, which nobody really sees week to week because it's, what, 12,000 people who subscribe to Honor Club who can see that weekly programming, and those who are in the arena when they shoot it. yeah, I guess that's my thoughts are his story and his journey for 2023 lies in the sister promotion.
Yeah, and this is the again with all this, and I get the context, the circumstances were such that I'm not going to be overly critical, but you know, introducing Mark to your larger audience. Again, it just goes to what we're saying. You know, I think Mark deserved more than Roderick. There's more to delve into with Mark's character, even if it's sort of not mid-card comedy, but sort of unhinged upper mid-card, you know, character with a lot of credentials and his. There's more to do with him to introduce to the larger Dynamite audience than say Roderick Strong, and they're doing it a little inductively, you know, getting people slowly invested in him, but pushing him at an equal level from the beginning. Okay. Up next, Azan's second question is, what do you think about the Britt Baker t-shirt stuff that's making the news cycle? Are you familiar with that, Eric?
I am.
Yeah. So Britt Baker, black guy, marketing a t-shirt. What do you think of the controversy?
I think the people who are criticizing the t-shirt are either operating out of ignorance or bad faith. If she had received the black eye as a result of Chris Jericho punching her, by all means, let's not have a t-shirt promoting man-on-woman violence. Good Lord in heaven, even for wrestling, that would be hitting the bottom of the barrel. But she got the black eye because she was attacked by the people she's feuding with, who are women. And to me, that comes across as more of a, you know, badge of honor, and they're making fun of her, you know, the heels have turned it against her and are making fun of her. And I'm, you know, I know that I think Fox News did a story about it when probably Fox News doesn't really care about wrestling content on its website. It's mostly, you know, politics. But wrestling stories tend to draw clicks. Speaking from experience in my former life, I know wrestling stories did well when they were put on the homepage. And so, you know, it just doesn't seem like 9 times out of 10, you would agree that there shouldn't be a t-shirt of this, but you know, we are precedent for this. Britt Baker had a t-shirt of when she was all bloodied up. Right. And there weren't complaints about that back then. Some of it seems a little misguided to me. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, I didn't have a like strong opinion on it, but I mean, I get the visual of just seeing a picture of a battered woman with a black eye with no context is going to, you know, raise some eyebrows. But the idea that it's like glorifying domestic violence, I felt was I get that can come across, but I just, it's sort of like the fault of the people looking at the t-shirt, drawing a conclusion that isn't based on fact, that is more the issue. I mean, I would have said no to the t-shirt. Like, let's not do this. And it might seem unfair, you know, Britt might be, but I think, you know, this is a badge of honor and I took a beating and I'm going to come. But it's like, it doesn't make sense to me that you would market the picture of the result of you getting beat up. So just like setting aside the domestic violence aspect, it just kind of feels like a weird marketing gimmick. Yeah. I think there's better t-shirts Britt Baker can make than that. And
you could have context is important, right? In everything.
Yeah. Yeah.
And if you had the heels marketing the t-shirt as a way to make fun of Britt, look how we got over on Britt, which they're doing a little bit of, or you had some sort of context on the t-shirt, like, some catchphrase, like I'm a badass and I'll fight alongside my man, or, you know, whatever trite catchphrase you'd put, you would contextualize it a little bit more. There is no context. And the shirt is, I thought I'd read that it was yanked, but it's on Pro Wrestling Tees right now. Britt Baker Battle Damage, available to order. So I guess they're still selling it. Chris Jericho is wearing that shirt tonight, right?
Cody Rhodes recently said is that the thing that people want him to sign more than anything is a photo of him when his, you know, chest and shoulder was all discolored. That's different than, you know, a photo that looks like a woman who is reporting, who's saying this is a result of my boyfriend or husband physically abusing me. And so I get that. I get that for some people, and I don't want to discount that for some people it's triggering. And I think that it should be, That should have been thought through before they put this out there. Even without getting to that level, I still think I think it's a bad idea. I don't know what slogan you can put on a T-shirt that would put that in context and not just feel weird. Like, if you're a male wrestling fan walking around with a T-shirt of a woman with a black guy, it's like, what? I mean, the assumptions people in the real world are going to make about that,
I agree with you. When there's a question about whether you should or shouldn't do something, generally that should be it should give you the answer. You shouldn't do it, right? If you're on the margin about this, if it's marginal, don't do it. You know, physician's first rule is cause no harm to your wrestling promotion. That said, I think the sort of attention this got was from people who didn't understand the context or didn't care to know, and, you know, just sort of sensationalized it. But again, to your point, AEW gave them the chance to do that by issuing the T-shirt and not saying no.
Eric, anything else in your notes you want to bring up?
About tonight's Dynamite?
Yeah.
I mean, I think so. The good parts, the best part was that every segment built toward the pay-per-view. They had I think maybe 8 matches got bills. The 6-man tag, Bullet Club, Blackpool Combat Club versus the Elite. Cole Jericho. I mean, Cole running up the ramp to beat Chris Jericho's ass to get revenge that he's wanted was one of the best parts of the show. I thought it's exactly what a babyface should do, right? It's the opposite of when there's this blood feud going on between two wrestlers, and then they circle each other and do a test of strength at the start of the match, right? It just doesn't make any sense. You should want to savage each other.
I think James Storm or Bobby Roode in TNA, I can't remember who their opponent was, but it was like this really intense like blood feud, and they did a collar elbow at the beginning, and I was just like, no.
Yeah. All of, 8 different matches by my count got angles or build, and even if it was just a video, pre-tape video interview. I think, Jade and Taya's presumed rematch, if they're going to continue that feud, where Taya gets to use her finisher. That's been more of a lot of a Rampage storyline anyway, maybe, I think. So maybe they'll build that there. Setting up the main event with promos was good. And I think I've covered the cons of tonight's show. We've covered that pretty well. We started with an opening 8-man tag that was good. And I am all for, if they were going to put the belt on Bandido that Orange Cassidy holds, doing it last week was, with no build and no reintroduction of Bandido and what he's about, wasn't the way to do it. I would love to see Orange Cassidy and Bandido team up through the summer, and then eventually Bandido asks for a rematch, right? Hey, friend, can I have a rematch? And Bandido is the one to dethrone Orange Cassidy, who's had, some record number of title defenses. So I think that's really about it.
My final question for you is, how are you feeling about Jay White and how AEW is portraying him? Sean Radican wrote a column in the Pro Wrestling Torch newsletter last week on that, highly critical of AEW's introduction of him. I mean, you can defend it if you're Tony Khan, if you think Jay White's going to be an upper mid-carder for you, or a borderline main eventer. And I just think people are critical of this. They're like, there's, Antonio go, oh, but Ricky Starks, you guys love Ricky Starks. This is good first feud. And Juice is the gatekeeper, the Roderick Strong to Adam Cole, as you said earlier, that kind of thing. But again, it comes down to, Jay White is now just merged into the speed of traffic on the highway. He's not anything special at this point.
Yeah, I know you only get one chance to make a first impression, but AEW has a big summer ahead, and there is still time. Jay White has not been defined so far down, right? Ricky Starks was a pushed guy. He was getting a television main event challenging for the AEW world title just in early December. And that's a good first feud. He will presumably beat Ricky Starks at the pay-per-view and, establish himself a little bit more. To me, the thing that's the most criminal thing AEW has done is not give Jay White a live mic, because that guy can cut a promo and he makes you think, and he makes you want to hate him. And in ring, I'm probably not as high on him as some others. I think he has this will be a reference you will appreciate as an AEW fan growing up. He has Zbysko tendencies, right? He'll, mm-hmm. he'll stall a lot outside the ring in the early part of his matches. And his whole gimmick is that he's, you know, he's a counter wrestler. So he counters the other guy's big move, right, into his finisher a lot of the time. And that doesn't always make for the most exciting matches. I am hopeful that they are bringing him along a little bit more slowly and they have plans to inject him into the main event scene because he could be a valuable player for them with the, you know, aging, older, more injury prone guys they have on top, you know, Jericho, Moxley, Omega, Punk, Danielson off the top of my head. You could put him into that mix and he will be an effective heel. His ceiling is, you know, world champion, right? Top guy. He's proven he can do that. And I thought we were going to get his babyface turn in New Japan in a big babyface run, and then the pandemic set in, and we never got a chance to see that. But that's probably not for years down the road, and he is definitely a more natural heel. So I have not given up hope yet.
Yeah, and giving up hope is overstating the – you don't have to give up hope, but you can be kind of bummed out that he's just, you know, getting typical treatment, with the idea being AEW's reputation is we bring people in at a certain level and we expect the fans to know who they are, or Excalibur will testify to it. And then that's how we create stars, is hiring stars. And I think people were hoping with Jay, there would be what you just did. They can't explain it in that way. Like, you can't say, oh, he's like Larry Zbysko and the way he draws and gets heat is this. But you show people that that's what he's all about. And they're just not doing that. Instead, they're like, look at what a good match he can have.
Yeah, the match with Commander was a styles clash from the first, when I saw the tweet that they announced it, I thought, man, that's a weird pairing. But, you know, I mean, he's coming in the middle of one of Tony Khan's quarterly cycles. So Tony's not one to alter his plans, likes to have things booked out. But, if nothing else, the fact that Tony Khan probably had to pay a pretty penny to get Jay White signed, because mm-hmm. there was probably somewhat of a bidding war for him with WWE, you know, if you're on a basketball team or a baseball team, you're going to get the at-bats or the minutes on the court if they're paying you like a starter, right? And so that has caused me to keep the faith a little bit. Either that or Tony Khan's fine with, wasting away money, I suppose.
I don't know what Jay White told Tony he was offered from WWE, but I heard from WWE, you know, that they didn't covet Jay White at a top main event level. Wasn't quite Vince McMahon's thoughts of Adam Cole, let's make him a manager. But, they saw him as, you know, third or fourth from the top heel. Mm-hmm. And we're not pursuing him as if it was a must signing. And that may have played into why he ended up in AEW too. You know, maybe Tony didn't have to get out the CM Punk, Bryan Danielson bank, level of offer, and wasn't willing to. But whatever. I mean, I'm sure he's getting paid well, and I'm sure Tony has big plans for him. But I doubt Jay White had an offer sheet that he brought to Tony that caused, you know, a huge bidding war based on what I heard out of WWE. But, that, you know, I don't know what that equates to. WWE has a lot of money to offer even third, fourth from the top heels. There's a lot of money going around.
Heels with proven track records of being able to, you know, main event, and who don't want to be cool heels who get the fans to cheer for them. Yeah. They're few and far between in 2023 in wrestling. So, I mean, you know, you saw what MJF went through last year when he was a babyface, but just refused to go with what the crowd wanted. And he had to work hard and very lowest common denominator to get back to where he is now. Right. Sometimes almost cartoonish ways. So when you have that natural heel that can, you know, like Rick Rude can lose the big one and still maintain his heat afterward. And I've just
good compare, yeah.
Jay
yeah.
White's tenure in New Japan. And in a lot of ways, Jay is like a Rick Rude in, you know, in terms of like you know, body type. They were both, you know, had a 6-pack or a 12-pack or whatever it is. Rick Rude probably a little more defined, but also probably had a little more help from mm-hmm. the chemical world on that. But, you know, that's the kind of healer you're talking about here if you use them correctly. So I'm keeping the faith.
And if Jay White were 4 to 6 inches taller, he would have gotten a main event offer from WWE. I mean, let's just be honest about that company. You know, that matters to them, too, when they look at who they want, the size they want of top pushed heels.
Yeah, yep, absolutely. Yeah. He would have had a great feud with Cody if he had gone the other way, though, I think.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. All right, cool. We can wrap up there, Eric. Thank you so much. It's fun talking AEW with you again.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Thanks, everybody, for listening, and we'll talk to you Friday night after SmackDown. And in between this week, you get to hear the Eric Kroll-endorsed fix as the also the simulcast as this week's Wade Keller Pro Wrestling Podcast flagship. So look for that Thursday night. We don't include the heralded mailbag portion in the flagship part of the fix when we simulcast the fix, but you'll get the current events section of it tomorrow night. So check that out. And I want to pitch to the Blue Meanie interview, like 2.5 hours of my interview with Brian Heffron. And it was really a journey through ECW. It was his reaction to the his review of the Barbed Wire City documentary that came out 10 years ago. But great stories on Paul Heyman and being behind the scenes in AEW. It's not always like the main eventers and the biggest names who are paying the most attention and convey the best stories. Sometimes it's the Blue Meanie types who are smart, observant, and around for a long time, who provide some of the best insight. And he did, and we put that up earlier this week on our Blue feed. So if you are interested in that era of wrestling, that is a add that to your list of must listens to hear his perspective. And on that note, thanks, Eric. Thanks to all our listeners once again, and we'll talk to you next time.